Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an amazing show for you this evening. Legendary NASA astronaut Dr. Story Musgrave is here. We are going to hear about his life story and so many amazing things. I cannot wait for you to meet him. Before we get started, just a few things. Social Flight is kicking with events going on throughout the country, around the world. It is flying season. So be sure to check out socialflight.com and the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. We have tens of thousands of aviation events, destinations. We've got our FAA learning system where you can get wings credits or renew your IA or learn things that aviation maintenance technicians and AMP mechanics get to learn. All sorts of great things there. And also our Fly to Win challenge where you can win prizes. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset to Landon Whiteman of Justin, Texas. He just won that. And now we are giving away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument August 1st. And all you need to do is get the mobile app and check in anywhere at your local airport, somewhere else, even one check-in, and you're entered to win that prize. If you fly in, check in at multiple places, you get a lot of points, get on our leaderboard, you get additional entries in order to be able to get a chance to win that amazing Aspen E5. I fly behind Aspen. I'm telling you, you're gonna enjoy that very, very much. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Whip Air and their amazing Whipline floats. They are a strong supporter of Social Flight. They are much, much more than floats, believe it or not. They're a full service paint, interior, avionics, maintenance, sales, you name it. It is all there at Whip Air. You can check out videos. We've gone and visited their facility. It's fantastic. And they're really an expert also in caravans. So there's some crazy stuff in the caravan world where everybody wants a caravan and they're able to help. So be sure to check all that out. And please tell them we said thank you from Social Flight. Now to tonight's guest, Dr. Franklin Story Musgrave is a living legend in the world of space exploration. Beginning his career in the Marines, he continued on to achieve no less than 6 higher education degrees, including a BS in mathematics from Syracuse, an MBA in computers and operations analysis from UCLA, a BA in chemistry from Marietta, an MD from Columbia, several postdoctoral positions, and even a master's in literature from the University of Houston. Musgrave was selected as an astronaut by NASA in 1967 as a member of NASA Astronaut Group 6. He worked on the Skylab program and participated in the design and development of all the space shuttle spacesuits, life support systems, airlocks, manned maneuvering units. A veteran of 6 space flights, he has spent over 1,281 hours in space, including nearly 27 hours outside the spacecraft on EVA. As if that were not enough, Story is the only astronaut to have flown on all space shuttles. And prior to John Glenn's return to space in 1998, Musgrave held the record for the oldest person to orbit at age 61. He has logged more than 20,000 flight hours in over 160 types of aircraft and is also a parachutist with more than 800 free falls. I am absolutely thrilled to have him with us tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Dr. Story Musgrave. Hello,
hey,
sir.
Jeff.
You know, I could talk for an hour about the things that are in your background. We wouldn't even get to the show. Your background's unbelievable. I would ask how we would do this, but
just deal with the fun stuff. Just do the fun stuff.
Well, so tell me about your background, because you even before there was a space program, you soloed way back at what, age 13?
Yes, I soloed off a pasture at age 13 by myself without instruction. You know, there was an airplane there and I took it flying. I did know what I was doing, though. I've always known what I was doing. I study it. I study things incredibly hard, and I look at the desired outcome, and believe me, it's very hard to get between Story Musgrave and the desired outcome. I have 1,000 free falls and I don't have a single story to tell you. I have no stories to tell you. I just did the details such that the outcome, you know, would be as I expected. So I took up parachuting. It's just fun. I'm at Columbia Medical School, and I heard people are falling through the air. Now, I thought that was unbelievably unusual. It's not unusual now, but the sport came from France. And the very first parachuting center, Parachutes Incorporated, that came from France was across the Hudson River. So I went over there and I took, my goodness me, this looks like something to do. And you cannot leave your family and to go fall out of an airplane. It's just irresponsible as the dickens. And so when I got married the summer before medical school, the kids were popping out every spring. And so medical school is 4 years. And of course, I ended up having four children at the end of medical school. But the point is, I cannot leave my family. I took my family with me to the parachuting center. And they are on the ground and they're hearing my instructor talking to me when I leave the airplane. And my family had gotten to know me. You're not messing with this guy. He's guaranteed. They look at my detail and you know the outcome is going to be good. And so that's basically what I do in life. I look at all the details and I force them to come out right.
I love that. That is absolutely amazing. Let's go back.
Parachuting is a good example of that. If it doesn't come out right, it's a bad result.
That is very true. Let's go back in time for everybody, because you're a couple things. Your family history goes back to the Mayflower.
Yes, I have several. I have several ancestors on the Mayflower.
Talk about like, the idea of going from the Mayflower in the family tree to space, that's a pretty impressive.
That's a funny. Good arc. I hadn't thought about that one. But yes, I am a New Englander, and I ended up being in Berkshire County.
And you had told me not only that, but you crossed paths growing up with Norman Rockwell.
Well, Norman, classically, and you know Norman, an incredible artist and illustrator. He had a tradition of riding through Main Street, Stockbridge, Mass., but he crossed the Housatonic and then he would enter our farm. So part of his standard evening bike ride was to go through our farm and we would grab him for dinner. And so we did get to know him very well. Now, he did end up with my 1859 cottage, but that was totally different. There was a different reason than the fact we were having dinner with him.
So did you ever wonder if one of your family dinners was going to show up on the Sunday Evening Post or one of those things?
No.
Did mom have to have a special spread out for Norman Rockwell to show up?
No, we just grabbed him off his bike.
Wow.
In for dinner. Yeah. And he was a great person, a wonderful, wonderful company.
So you started your career in the Marines. Tell me about that first.
I started off in the Marines as an engine mechanic. And so I did have a rather high IQ. And so what do you do when the Marine got a high IQ? You make him an engine mechanic. I started, you know, working on aircraft engines and working on a 3,000 horsepower piston engine on the Douglas AD Sky Raiders. Man, I had my life full of that. Then it became the youngest crew chief in Marine Corps history. A crew chief is one that coordinates all the different maintenance specialties and certifies this airplane as airworthy to go to war. And I ended up in Korea during the war. And I am signing off a green check mark saying this airplane is airworthy and it can go. And I'm doing that at the age of 18. That is massive responsibility for an 18-year-old. And then from there, I started flying in the right seat of the Douglas AD Sky Raider as an air ground coordinator. You work with the ground and then you pass this on and you build a mission for the pilot.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
And then, so yes, sorry to interrupt. My I was in Korea, K6, Pyeongtaek. Then I went on the carrier, the USS Wasp. And so one of my airplanes did go in the water, you know, and you, in those days, you got to the end and you went swimming or flying. And I, there's nothing I can do. If I do what I can do, but if it ain't got the power, you know, the wind over the deck and the wind and the power, well, there's nothing I can test. And so they never said anything to me. They know darn well I'd done the best job I could. Mm-hmm. And it's so ironic, and it's not there in the books much. Years later, on the same USS Wasp, in the same Douglas AD Sky Raider, my brother, he died. And so he hit the water, but he got run over by the carrier. And so we did not get him out. That's just part of the business.
Wow.
And that's not in my bio or anything.
Wow. That is so when the war ended, is that that's when you decided to go to Syracuse?
The war was still on when I was in Korea, but the fighting had stopped. You know, the fighting stops and the war gets declared over later on. But I had to leave the Marines anyway. Without high school, I can't go anywhere. I can't be a pilot. I can't be an officer. I can't go anywhere in the Marines without a high school diploma. So I left the Marines to go and get some education.
And that's what took you to it's interesting because you went from there into into college.
Yes. My first major is mathematics and statistics, that kind of stuff.
So tell me, what was it like getting into college, coming back from Korea, but no high school diploma?
And none of them took me, but I showed up at Syracuse anyway. I'm on a quadrangle asking people how I fix this situation. Well, the dean does that. So I went and found the dean's office. I charged by the secretaries and I said, sir, product of child labor, I never finished high school and I'm back from the Marines in Korea. I'm ready to go to work. He never even asked my name. He walked me out front, matriculated this gentleman.
Wow.
You can't turn down a teenager who's back from Korea. You know, you really just give him a semester, give him a shot at it. And so 15 years later, I got an honorary doctorate from them and delivered the overall commencement address.
That must have felt amazing.
And it is funny, but my younger brother, he joined the Marines at 17. He never finished school either. And he's leaving the Marines and he says, none of the colleges will take me. I said, try Syracuse. And Syracuse said, my God, we're doing this again, but we do know the result. Now, don't laugh too hard, Jeff. It's not over. So I have I have children from age 65 to 18. I do have a 37-year-old who happens to be flying B-1s with the Air Force out of Dyess. He messed up so bad in high school, he didn't get a high school diploma. He just messed up his whole record. And he said, Dad, there's no way I can get to college. I said, try Syracuse. And Syracuse says, my God, we're doing this again. But we know the outcome. So, and I got little Story, who's 18, and she didn't bother to finish high school. But I told her, Syracuse is waiting on you. It's waiting for you. You'll be the fourth Musgrave to go there without a diploma. Life is funny.
That may be the funniest thing I have heard.
But the result, you look at the result, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, what's to argue with? You know exactly what the result is going to be. You're going to have
the result with Little Story will be the same. I know what Little Story will chill him out to.
So that is amazing. So with most people who you would talk to who were astronauts, they would tell you stories of imagining themselves as being an astronaut when they were a kid, but there was no space program. Tell me what was your evolution to NASA?
My evolution, I got saved. I got saved by NASA because I was in this aviation world, seriously in aviation, doing a bunch of it. I was a very serious parachutist. I have the only one that has 100 experimental parachute jumps, and that is to establish the aerodynamic and aeronautical characteristics of the free-falling human being. And so we had two recording theodolites. I'd leave the airplane and two telescopes would record me coming down. And so I'm doing all that kind of stuff. But my goodness, the space program happened and I saw that NASA's interested in the scientist astronaut, and that'll save the day. That will utilize everything I have ever done in life. I can do the whole thing, you see. Professionally do the whole thing. And so it kind of saved the day. And so I left surgery. I'm training as a neurosurgeon. A neurosurgeon and neurophysiologist. How do we get to there?
Okay, hold on. Yeah, I was gonna say you have to go back for a bit because I didn't realize I was skipping that fast.
No, I'll quickly hit that one. I was in computers at UCLA, a programmer, an assembler, a compiler. But I got interested in how the brain works. Brains don't have vacuum tubes. Yes, the computer had a vacuum tube back then. But I got fascinated by the brain. I should have told myself, leave it alone. I can't leave it alone. I'm going to do the brain. I must know what's in the head. So it was computers that led me to neurophysiology and neurosurgery. And so that was why I was traveling from UCLA I'm just going back to Syracuse, I'm already registered, but I run into this 200-year-old town that's on the Ohio River and the Muskingum River, and my God, is a college here at Marietta College. And so I go in there and I ask them, do you have pre-med here? And they said, sir, we are a college, of course we have. Do you have an application? Yeah, we got one of those too. So that's why I did my major in chemistry, getting ready for medical school. And then, of course, we're up to Columbia. Now, I am heading with informal training to be a neurophysiologist and a neurosurgeon. That's where I'm heading. But, oh, my goodness, the space program happened. And I said, you know, that's saving the day. That's saving the day for someone who can't make up their mind. You don't have to make up your mind. You do the whole thing. And so, but my surgery boss that I'm in training with, he asked me why I wouldn't be with him the next year. He absolutely adored me, of course. And you know how I found him? I found him leaving medical school. He was taking the Marines. He was taking beachheads with the Marines with a backpack on, trying to save lives with just his hands. I heard about him and he said, that's my kind of person. So I ended up training with him. But when I'm heading for the space program, he says, where are you going? The space program, okay. Well, the same day that I moved to Houston to join the astronaut corps, he became chairman at University of Colorado. He called me up on the phone and said, Story, if you can break away from NASA 2 or 3 days a month, we're going to do trauma. So for the next 30 years, while an astronaut, I did trauma surgery with the University of Colorado in Denver. So you see how life works. He just gave me a ring and he and I, we just hit it off. You know what I mean? So there you go. Life is fun.
And so which part of this program were you studying free fall on the human body?
That was at the University of Kentucky when I'm working on an MS there, and most of my studies were in aeronautical engineering. And so a course in aeronautical engineering, they wanted us to come up with a research project, and I came up with a research product of what is the aerodynamics free fall in the human body. So it became a class project, which was very nice for getting the data done.
And that involved doing a whole bunch of experimental jumps.
Well, not experimental, just free fall. But establishing the different L over Ds, establishing different fall rates, establishing different body configurations, But like I said, we had two telescopes. They were a mile apart, and the two telescopes, each one would be on me when I leave the airplane. And so each telescope is tracking my position. And the two of them put together, so I got my position every 20th of a second coming down. So it was very easy for the class then to come up with the aerodynamics of the human body.
Wow. That is a crazy amount of stuff in a short period of time, from mathematics to chemistry to med school to free fall of the human body to
I guess I've been lucky, huh?
Wow. Okay. So now bring me and all of us to how NASA comes into the picture.
NASA came into the picture when I'm in my surgical and neurophysiological training, and they came up with a scientist astronaut program. And I looked at that program, and it'll save the day. I can do everything. So I can be a professional in every single thing that I just dabbled in the past. It'll fully utilize Story Musgrave's capabilities, and it did.
Tell me about joining NASA and your initial training and your selection.
Well, I did get in the program. And so we had 13,000 applicants, and six of us got to space. That's six out of 13,000. Those are kind of bad numbers. But we went through all the astronaut training, a lot of it classroom, a lot of it academic, a lot of it science, a lot of it engineering, but a lot of it also very practical stuff like spacesuits and centrifuges and pulling Gs and flying. So you had to, the first thing I did after a few months at NASA, they wanted everyone to be a military pilot. So they sent all of us off to the Air Force to be military pilots. Even though we were scientists, they wanted us to be a military pilot. And my year with the Air Force was one of the loveliest years of my entire life. It was absolutely glorious. And of course, I'm not bragging. I'm just with Jeff Simon, and I'm giving you the facts. I got the highest scores in the entire history of the Air Force.
Wow.
I was cheating somewhat because I had an airline transport rating at the time. I had gotten that years and years earlier just for the sake of doing it. But again, it's due to details, and it's living the situation. But the Air Force was so great. I just adored that year. But then I came back to NASA, and of course we dove into all the different kinds of training. But we maintained our proficiency. They wanted you to continue as a pilot to maintain your flying skills. And so we maintained our proficiency within NASA with the Northrop T-38 aircraft. It was supersonic and one of the sweetest airplanes ever designed. So even within NASA, we maintained our flying proficiency. And I, of course, became the lead instructor. Yes, I'm teaching other astronauts how to fly. I was the lead standardization and evaluation. And that's, setting all the rules. And I was also your head maintenance test pilot. A maintenance test pilot is when an airplane's been under heavy maintenance, you go to fly to see that it works. And I'm still here.
You've got a good background for that, that's for sure.
Because I was an airplane mechanic, I was an engine mechanic, and I had all the rest of that. That's why I got the job.
Was the Air Force experience the first time that you'd gone to jet aircraft, turbine aircraft, or had you done that before?
I had to think a little bit. No, I had no jets.
So tell me about the money. Transition through to jets with the Air Force and then flying the T-38.
Jets are simpler, straight ahead thrust, simple motors. But the T-38 is a totally magical, unbelievable airplane. The most honest beauty that ever happened. It's never done anything to anyone. There's not a single record, and it's 60 years old. There is not a single record of it doing something unexpected.
Really?
It is one spectacular machine. It is supersonic, and it's incredibly maneuverable, two rolls in a second. So it's a gorgeous machine.
That's is it true that you had an incident, at least in it, with fire lights or something like that?
Yes. I had an incident. I had both engines on fire. And so not only one, but the, of course, the checklist says fire confirmed and you can't get the fire out, eject. And the accident board said you had two of them. What were you waiting on, Story? The airplane trying to get me home, and I'm not leaving it. So I was taking off out of El Toro. I'll do this pretty fast. To the east over the mountains. And I had a compressor stall on the left engine. T-38s never compressor stall. They never, ever do this. But I heard an explosion. I see the left engine rolling back. And so I pull it back to idle and hit the start button to try to save that left engine. And then the right fire light comes on. Not the one compressor stall. The right fire light came on. So I got one on fire. The tower calls me NASA 924. And yes, I was NASA 924. You are trailing fire and smoke, and pieces are falling from the airplane. Advise your intentions. I slid a slow right 270. I'll land to the west. And so I'm coming around there, and I see that I'm in full afterburn the right motor, but I got to have it. I only got one motor, so I got an engine on fire, and I'm getting all the power I can out of an engine on fire. That's not a good thing to do. But I see I have caught the left engine in idle. So I said, my goodness, I'll get that left engine up and I can get the fire engine off. I start pushing up the power on the left engine and the left fire light comes on. So I got them both. I got them both on fire now. So I just brought them around and landed. But, you know, the board said you're supposed to eject, but the board didn't understand. I'm saying, she's trying to get me home, and I'm not leaving this beauty. I don't care if I have to go out with her. The board totally understood that. Well, I land, and of course, in the Marines, they position the fire trucks in the midfield. They're not back there. So the fire trucks are on top of me in no time. They got that out, and the fire warden says, young man, I'm 55. Okay. Have you any idea what you've done? I'm looking at the back of the airplane, and I'm really wondering if I should have ridden this out. There's nothing left back here. Nothing back. He says, I'm not worried about the airplane. You look over there. I said, 22 fires in the community. The Santa Ana community with pieces falling from the airplane. I said, two fires on base, 22 in the community, and two more on the base when I came around. And so the main, quickly, I'll wrap it up. The main problem was on the left engine, the afterburner pipe hose came off of the engine. And I did discover a problem in wells. A whole bunch of other airplanes had the wells. I'm just the one that paid for it. You are full afterburner fuel inside the airplane, not in the motor. And so it burnt through the firewall, and it set off the fire in the right engine. It set it off first, even though the right engine didn't have any problem at all. And later on, of course, that was the problem.
Wow. And then they discovered that same problem on the other aircraft.
Yes. A weld problem. But it just happened to me. Anyway, you asked about this little incident. There you go.
I think we're all glad that you made it through that.
I'm still here.
So, help me with the timeline at NASA, because I don't want to get this wrong. But you worked on Skylab, you worked on life support systems, and then you went into space. So tell me about that.
I worked on Apollo just to help them get there. I was not assigned to an Apollo crew, but I did join NASA years and years before Apollo. But then Apollo happened, so I did help them with Apollo. The next program was Skylab, and that was our very first space station. And so that was, Saturn 1B and Apollo to take it to the space station. So I was a backup on the very first one, the first Skylab mission. So I helped on Skylab. I was a capsule communicator on Skylab, and so important. I was a capsule communicator for 25 missions. And that is the lead communicator in mission control. Mission control is the best decision-making process I have ever run into. They are absolutely beautiful, democratic, and pulling out the best possible ways of doing things. But I was, yes, I have my own six flights, but I had 25 missions from the lead communicator in mission control. So I did that for Skylab. And then down to the shuttle program. I did end up being a specialist. I was your lead spacewalker for 25 years. I am a physician. I am a physiologist. And I know tools and I know equipment, so it was a natural thing, for me to fall into spacewalking, EVAs. I was your lead NASA spacewalker for 25 years. I was on Challenger's first flight, and I did the first shuttle spacewalk on Challenger. I was the first one to get out the door to test all the spacesuits on that and Challenger, and I deployed a satellite too. And then, of course, I was your lead mechanic to repair Hubble Space Telescope on the first mission to Hubble. I was on Hubble for 18 years before I went to fix it. 18 years, yeah. It's not just be assigned a mission a year ahead of time. They told me in 75, Story Musgrave, yes, sir. We're going to put a big telescope in space. You identify every failure that can happen to. Come up with the tools and procedures to be able to fix anything that could happen to Hubble. So I did that for 18 years, from 75 till 93, when I flew that mission to go and save it. I was not cynical enough over those 18 years to think they would put the wrong mirror in the telescope and not check on it. I was not that cynical, but I had to put some lenses on it.
Wow. Let's go back. Tell me about your development of all the life support systems and the spacesuits, and then what it was like to test those yourself in space.
It's pretty straightforward stuff. Of course, I was on the shoulders of giants along the way, but I'm a physiologist, I'm a physician, and I know the ergonomics and I know the joints. And, I can bring that kind of stuff, and I'm a mechanic. So it was a natural for me to get into spacesuits and space development. So there's a whole bunch of testing on the ground. And of course, our major training is in the water tank. It's not in the zero G airplane. Our major spacewalking training is in the water tank. And so you jump in a spacesuit and then they hang weights all over you in the right places, so that you don't float to the top, you don't sink to the bottom of the pool, and you are also rotationally stable. So believe it or not, our main spacewalking training is in the water tank. I'm not. Did I answer your question there?
Yeah.
It was a natural.
You did. I'm also curious, though, not many people who are involved in the design of something that has to do with space also get to use it and experience it in space. That must have been unique.
It was lovely. It was unique and lovely. I'm glad I got to do that.
Tell me about, you talked about Hubble a bit. Tell me what it was like to go see Hubble in space, and then what it was like to work on it.
Yeah, it's one big and beautiful machine. The working on it, it's an athletic event. If you have really wired the thing, if you really know what you're doing, you are as precise as an athlete. And I trained with Dorothy Hamill, and I trained with a bunch of other athletes. It's a high jumper. It's a pole vault. It's whatever you want to do. That is what a spacewalk is. You look at the job you got to do. You get the tools and you get the procedures. You choreograph what you're going to do, then you keep doing it until you are as precise as an Olympic athlete. And then you go and do it, and doggone it, it comes out the way it is supposed to. I know that's boring. I know it's a bore, but my whole, every single operation, except for a couple surprises. One, a door wouldn't close. So Jeff Hoffman's working on a door and won't close. And finally, Mission Control said, "Story, go close the door." Okay, I got to come along. You know, a come along. It's a come along like a come along. So, but you would, I know it's really boring, but when I go fake sample, I want it to come out. I want to choreograph it. I want to come out like a dance. I want an athletic event in which it occurs like this. I can't afford to have surprises. You have enough surprises, one, I'm going to get you. And one, I'll fix Hubble, I'll fix Hubble. And when you got 1,000 parachute jumps, I'm not leaving that up to luck.
Right. Wow. That makes sense. So there weren't the only surprise that you had to deal with was a door that wouldn't close and you had to use that?
That's about it. And so I can't think of, they're all minor surprises. Yeah, that's the only one that occurs to me right now.
Tell me about your first mission into space and what it was like to viscerally to go through the G's and the experience of launching on the shuttle.
That was on Challenger's first flight. And of course we launch in an escape suit and we train on a centrifuge and the G's of course are through the chest, you know. They're from front to back, so you couldn't pull that many G's head to foot. So they're front to back and they're not bad. Okay, 3.5 front to back. So the G's aren't too bad. 0G is a pile of fun. And for me, it is a pile of fun. Now 70% of astronauts get ill in space due to 0G. 50% are vomiting. And so, but me, the more funny things happen to me, I just celebrate and say, "Give me more, baby. I love this kind of stuff." Instead of resisting it, instead of saying, "I don't like this. Hey, I'm in space and 0G is part of the game, so give it to me, baby. I love, the more you give it to me, the more I'm going to love it." And so I do well with 0G, but it is very serious because some astronauts can be sick and be still getting the job done. Others cannot get the job done. They're hanging on the wall for maybe more than 2 days. Some are ill for two and two-thirds days. You have to do their job for them, and maybe you weren't trained to do their job for them. And so if you get a large crew and half of them are hanging on the wall, you really have to work hard to pull that mission off. Zero G is a fun, it's a critical thing. And of course we have zero G in the airplane. For the spacewalk, we train in the water tank, but the zero G airplane, it does give you a little chance to mess with it. But I think it's just fun. When the engine shut down, man, here you are. Ooh. And I have endless games. I have endless games in 0G. You ought to see some of the games I play. So I do sleep floating. I drop myself and I don't know where I'm gonna end up, but I just drop myself and I float. I float while I sleep, and I think that is a pile of fun myself. To sleep floating and not know whether you're up or down, or you know. And you do, it's funny, even in 0G, Jeff, you need to know the up and down. The up and down on Earth is so critical here. You know, it's so critical. The down direction is critical. Your feet, your head up. The down direction is absolutely critical. Where Earth is and where the sky is critical. When you go into 0G, you have to know, you continue to know the up and the down, even though there is no up and down, you carry an up or down with you. So that's one of the interesting parts about 0G.
So where do you position it? Is it relative to the spacecraft that you're in, or is it relative to where Earth is? How do you do that?
Yeah, you got the right answer. And so if you got a massive face full of Earth, that's going to be down. If you got a huge face full of Earth, you're immersed in Earth, you know, that's probably going to be the down. If you get a face full of the spaceship, and you've been training in the spaceship in a certain position where the down is always in the same place in that spaceship while you train in it, and you get immersed in that, then that would be the down. So the down varies. But you got to put it somewhere, and it's going to go somewhere, and I don't care if it's zero G. We evolved. We evolved in on Earth. We evolved in 1G. And so it's there.
That is pretty amazing. I never thought about that. That's something that you have to carry with you as you go forward in that.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you hey, yeah, but it makes total sense since you evolved over millions of years, and the down is absolutely critical. The down is critical living here on Earth.
What's another kind of game or something that you kind of like enjoyed during your time in space?
Looking out the window is absolutely gorgeous. It is one incredible view. So the zero G is magical, but Earth, the views of Earth and the views of the heavens that you see out there and the sunsets that you see. And so Earth is absolutely magnificent. The oceans and the blue waters and the mountains, anyway, I can carry on the deserts forever. So seeing this gorgeous planet from out there is a key part of the spaceflight experience. It's getting the job done, of course. You're up there for a purpose. Mm-hmm. Zero is a very important and unique part about spaceflight, but also the view is totally unique. To be out there and to see entire continents, to see the entire United States, you know, in one view, and to see the ice, to see the poles, to see the blue waters, and to see storms and clouds, the whole thing. And so what you see out the window and the view of the planets, of course, you get to know your astronomy pretty good, but the view of the planets is also absolutely magnificent. The aurora borealis and the various kinds of radiation that you can see up there. So out the window is a critical part of spaceflight experience.
My understanding is that you were one of the only people that has taken video footage of some of like the plasma and things that you've had been seen through the glass. Tell us a little bit about that, and also a story if you happen to have a light switch near you, it looks like the sun is set and we don't see you quite as much anymore.
Oh, okay. Let me go try to fix that.
I don't want people to think that you're only ahead. There we go.
Is that right?
Wonderful. Perfect. Thank you. So you were about to explain a little bit about some of the phenomenon that you had the opportunity to see and photograph.
Yeah, the radiation is a very important part, and the plasma, you can see it. It's there. So, but I'd have to work on that. What unique? I need some time to think about.
No worries. Tell me a little bit about with all the time you spent outside, 27 hours outside, doing EVAs. That must have been very special to be the one of very few astronauts getting the view of everything from out there. Talk to me a little bit about that experience.
It's not that I was unique. It's that I had that experience, and I'm a mechanic and an engineer, and I'm a physiologist, so I'm totally at home with the suit. Mm. I know why the suit's there, and I'm totally at home with that. And so, but I do view myself as a Dorothy Hamill. I view myself as here's the job. you know, here's the job I need to do. I'm at the Olympics. And it is that kind of precise, and it's not compulsive. There's nothing compulsive about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way you get the job done. It's the way you got 1,000 free falls, and it's okay. I have no surprises. I don't want any surprises.
Yeah.
And so it's the fun of the details. It's the fun. But it's the choreography of the event, and then continuously getting better until finally you've got it down what you're going to do. And then you go up there and pull it off. But you are still loving zero G. You're loving a suit, and you're loving a view. You're loving a view.
When you think about the view and the appreciation of the beauty of it, really makes me think about the continuing arc of your life, where moving on from NASA, you're so involved in artistry and vision and futurism. Tell us a little bit about where you've gone since then.
Art is everywhere. Art is everywhere, and you can apply art everywhere. And I don't care what you work on, artistic ability is going to matter. And so that is part of my thinking now as a futurist, and how I can find the right art, how I can apply the right kind of art. And so if nothing else, well, it's probably, if you wanted one thing, Story Musgrave is, I'm an artist. That's a huge compliment, but I think that's where I am.
You were with Walt Disney's Imagineering prior to Applied Minds. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a very creative process. And of course, we're doing all the theme parks. We're doing all the machines. We're doing all the rides. We're doing, Disney Imagineering can do the whole thing. And so it was a very, very creative. I was only there for 2 years, maybe three, two or three. And so it's a very, very creative process. And you're looking at the experience you're going to give other people. And that's a pile of fun.
Mm. And tell me about Applied Minds, where you are.
Applied Minds, I'll work on every single project in all every kind of way. But I think where I really come through is as a futurist. A company has a certain idea of their future. They got certain ideas about where they can go from here. And where they couldn't go from here, and they have an idea of how the future is going to turn out. Well, I come up with alternate futures for them.
Hmm.
I show them there are other possibilities, and there's other things they can do. There's other futures they can take, and I'm always coming up with alternate solutions. They have a way of doing business, and I come up with a different way. Not always better sometimes, but I do come up with a different way of getting the job done.
Is that kind of view of alternate way of getting places something you think that applies to individuals and their personal futures and their personal paths in their lives in addition to companies?
Yes. I guess I'm applying my own life to them. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, that's it. I mean, I have to think that way. It's what I've done. And so I was always open. I was always open to what the heck's going to happen next. And I was always open to some other future. I never planned it where nothing, you know, I never had such a strict plan that nothing else could happen. I always had a rather loose plan that if I run into surprises, if I run into opportunities, I'll be able to take them, and I did. So I think you're right, Jeff. It's a good observation that what I've done with my personal life and works, it's very close to what I do for other companies.
And what do you see as kind of you're at this point, you're 89. You're going to be a 90 soon.
I'm doing a big one next year. Doing 90 next year.
90 next year. So you're probably having about your midlife crisis now. you're about halfway there. What are you most excited to see that's coming next?
In my personal life or in the world?
How about both? Anything?
Yeah. Well, the world is incredibly dynamic, of course, and some it's not always nice, unfortunately. The world is not always nice. I wish it were much more peaceful and harmonious, and I wish people were working just as hard at getting along as they are to not getting along. And so, you know, I wish that would happen out there. But there's a pile of stuff going on. AI is not the total answer. But if you look at AI, I went from computers to neurophysiology 60 years ago. So my goodness, I was on the cutting edge of AI 60 years ago. So yeah. It's one opportunity. But Jeff, the important, the bottom line is love what you do.
Yeah.
You can't be good and life is too short. I know I'm going to make it to 100, but I'm aiming at 100.
Oh, I'm aiming for more for you.
I can get stopped overnight. I can get stopped, but it's something I'm working at. I run 4 miles a day. I got an exercise. Yes, I got an exercise room. And I work real hard on it. I just came from my condo in Cape Canaveral, so I have a 4 mile run down the beach through Jetty Park and out on a pier down there. And I have a beautiful exercise room. And so exercise is part of it, exercise and diet, but it's also attitude. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's just life's fun.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful. Well, Story, this is the time of the program that we like to do something we call Social Flight's Fast Five, where we ask you 5 questions about your opinions or your life that we have. So, Story Musgrave, are you ready for Social Flight's Fast Five?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay. Question number one. With 160 plus types of aircraft, over 20,000 hours in your logbook, what is your personal favorite of looking back of an aircraft or something that's really close to your heart?
The Northrop T-38, a supersonic airplane, totally honest, totally beautiful, totally simple. Simple, beautiful, fast, 2 rolls a second, you know. That's my honey. That is my honey. I am in love with it, and it's 60 years old.
Absolutely love that. Okay, question number two. Was there some moment of your life that was especially challenging or maybe perhaps a scary moment or something that you learned something from that you can think of?
Yeah. So everyone in my life committed suicide. My great-grandfather shot himself. My grandfather shot himself. My father shot himself. My brother shot himself. My son shot himself. Uncle took rat poison. Cousin tried to do it with a motorcycle, but he ended up paraplegic, but he took his wheelchair on the highway and he ended up there. And so there are many more. And so, but you ask me, you know, those are my moments. Those are my moments where I take a hard look at life. But it's the life that Story Musgrave is, you know, you didn't maybe know about all that, but I have had to live through that, and I've had to, you know, suffer, and I've had to regret, and I've had to hurt.
Wow, that's very powerful, and I'm sorry that you had to go through that. Well, let's move to question number three.
I'm sorry to stun you, but that's a key point.
No, this is your truth, and I'm sorry you had to live through that. But it's having such a wonderful life history, and what you've done with your life against that backdrop is all the more incredible. As to making you the human that you are. And perhaps
I also have different genetics. And I have to understand that, you know, I have different genetics, but I put it to good use.
Well, question number three that may tie in on a positive note of that is, if you had the opportunity to go back and re-experience, not to change something, just to put yourself back for a moment of your life to re-experience something wonderful or of any kind, what would that moment be that if you could kind of go and relive?
It's my kids, it's my children. It's my kids being born, it's my kids meeting major milestones in life. And so we didn't get too much into that, but my children, they are my life. They're why I live. And it's every night. I talk to them every night, and I'm like this with them. I'm incredibly tight. My kids is my life.
I love that. And you have seven kids ranging from 18 to 65. Is that correct?
Yes. So far.
So far. That's right.
It ain't over till it's over.
I love that.
But I must confess that one. I must confess, Jeff, without getting too detailed, that is over.
I don't know. I'm not counting you out of anything, Story. I'm just saying, from what I know from our relationship, I'm not counting you out of anything. Okay.
So the major things are major events in my children's lives that I could share with them.
That's absolutely wonderful. Great. Question number four. If there was one, if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, someone in your teens or 20s, and say in what advice or what words would you give to your younger self if you could go back in time and do that?
Gee, that's a tough one to come up with in the time I gotta come up with. Well, I've said it before, it's do what you love. It's do what you love. It's follow that passion.
Got it.
But that's a natural thing. That should be a natural thing in life. It should be very natural. Do what you love, and it'll come out right, and you'll be good at it.
I love that. And question number five, last question. If you could choose anyone from history, alive, dead, who you've maybe never met, but just anyone on the planet, or who was on the planet, to sit down and have a drink with, or a meal, or spend some time with, is there anyone that comes to mind that is someone from present or history that you would like to have a conversation with?
I'm sorry.
Perhaps a different astronaut.
Yeah, my brother, the one that went on, that hurt the worst. I'd like to meet up with him, my brother Tom.
So your brother Tom that passed away in the Korean War?
No.
Or after?
That was suicide. They were all suicide.
Got it. Well, I wish that you had the opportunity to do that. Well, Story, thank you so much. You have a book also where people can get to know you. I believe The Way of Water.
Yes, written by Anne Lenihan from Australia. She did a beautiful job. That's really nailed it.
Well, Story Musgrave, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here. Your time is precious. I'm really, really grateful for it and to share it with everyone. And you have had and continue to have a remarkable life. And I'm so happy for you and your large family that you get to spend so much quality time with.
Yes.
And thank you so much for coming on Social Flight Live to share all of this with us.
Well, thank you for bringing me on. It was an incredible event. We had a super time, and we dealt with just wonderful subjects, wonderful ideas. Thank you.
Excellent. Have a wonderful evening, and I will talk to you soon, my friend.
Okay, Jeff, Simon.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. And thank all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday with artist Sam Lyons. If you are not familiar with Sam Lyons' aviation art, I will tell you it is fantastic. And if there is something that is even more fantastic than his artwork, it's his personal story of flying behind the art. It is really something. He's a great guy, and he's going to be here on the show again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. That's July 2nd. Great way to kick off your July 4th week. And then the week after that, on Tuesday, July 9th, Brian Allen, the human-powered pilot who flew the first human-powered flight with the Gossamer Albatross across the English Channel, will be here on the show. He is a renowned hang glider pilot, and just so many things about him that make him a very special human being. So please join us again here on Social Flight Live. I appreciate everything that you do for general aviation as well, and I wish you all blue skies.